National Foundation, providing schools that work, strategies for 21st century success. Learn more at edutopia.org.
News from NPR is made possible by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
Hi, this is Masumi Rostad of the Pacifica String Quartet. Please join WILL 40 North Krannert and me for the new Docha Chamber Music Festival. We are playing at Radio Maria, Cakes on Walnut, and Jim Gould's in downtown Champaign, April 1st to 3rd. Docha will feature great music from some of our town's finest musicians, including Stefan Milenkovich, Dmitry Kuzov, Rudolf Hawken, and my group, the Pacifica Quartet. Admission is free. For more information, visit docha.org.
It's 6 minutes past 1 o'clock. Today, the afternoon magazine features an interview from the AM 580 archives. Since it's a recorded interview, we won't be taking phone calls this afternoon. From Illinois Public Media, this is the Afternoon Magazine. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Pleased that you could join us today. Architect, planner, designer, these are some of the words we can use to describe Frank Lloyd Wright. He was also a builder of communities of young architects and draftsmen who supported his work. Today we're going to take a fresh look at Frank Lloyd Wright. Our guest is Myron Marty, a professor and dean emeritus at Drake University. He's looked at life within the Taliesin Fellowship and Wright's other collaborative communities. Myron Marty is the author of Communities of Frank Lloyd Wright, Taliesin and Beyond. Listeners, your questions and comments are invited. I look forward to hearing from you. You can join us with a phone call or by email. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Our toll-free number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. And our email address, will-talk@illinois.edu. Myron Marty is a former member of the Board of Trustees of the Frank Lloyd Wright Foundation, as well as the Board of Taliesin Preservation Incorporated. He's also been a longtime book reviewer for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Myron Marty is the author or co-author of many books. He is co-author with Shirley Marty of Frank Lloyd Wright's Taliesin Fellowship. That book was published by the Truman State University Press. His latest, Communities of Frank Lloyd Wright, Taliesin and Beyond, is published by the Northern Illinois University Press. Again, our phone numbers, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And the email address, will-talk@illinois.edu. Myron Marty, thanks so much for coming in and talking with us this afternoon.
It's my pleasure to be here.
So where does Frank Lloyd Wright stand among architects, past and present?
Well, I think he always considered himself at the top. In fact, after testifying before a legislative committee, before he testified, they asked him to identify himself. He said, Frank Lloyd Wright, world's greatest architect. And when he emerged, his wife said to him, why in the world did you say that? And he said, I was under oath.
Mm-hmm. In 1930, he declared that it was his intention not only to be the greatest architect who has yet lived, but the greatest who will ever live.
He tried to live up to that.
Yeah. How did his time with Louis Sullivan influence him in terms of the persona he created for himself?
I think he followed that very closely. He and Sullivan were very close. He called himself the pencil in the master's hand. He always called Sullivan Liebermeister, his beloved master. And then they drifted apart after Wright had his own practice. When he described Sullivan to someone, it sounded almost as though he was describing himself. The difference is that Sullivan had one wife for a very short time and Wright had three and a lover along the way.
Does Frank Lloyd Wright continue to have an influence in architecture today, and if so, how?
If you ask architects today, they will tell you that there are many features of contemporary architecture that are traceable to Frank Lloyd Wright. For example, the use of a cantilever. That's an unsupported projection coming out. That's Falling Waters, the most famous one. The most stark one that I've seen is that carport at the Rosenbaum House in Florence, Alabama. It's just like a shelf coming out of the house under which people park their car. And so he was sort of a groundbreaker in that respect. I think another respect in which he was influential is that he was always ready to experiment. And architects today that experiment follow his model with that.
He was a Midwesterner. He was born in Wisconsin and began to make his mark in Chicago. How did this geography affect him?
Well, he was a thoroughgoing Midwesterner until he wasn't anymore. He saw himself as a man of the land. That accounts for his development of the prairie-style architecture. That was what he did. Many of his early designs were that. He always believed in organic architecture, which he interpreted to be appropriate to the time and appropriate to the place and appropriate to the man, that is, to the people who would be living in it. And I think that those ideas have not all architects call themselves organic architects, but those principles still do pervade a lot of architecture. Wright was also good at making enemies, and he hated the international style, although he got along with Mies van der Rohe. They had a split later on. Wright maintained very few lifelong friends because of his personality. But the international style is, if you've seen the campus of the Illinois Institute of Technology in Chicago, that was all designed by Mies van der Rohe. That's much more box-like.
Right.
And Wright's philosophy was destroy the box. And so you'll go into his, like the Hillside Home School, that's now the headquarters for the Taliesin Fellowship in Wisconsin. The corners of the building do not support the roof. They're supported by columns inside. And he tried to find a way to make places less boxy.
Yeah. He was a small D Democrat, although he was quite autocratic.
Yeah.
Maybe you would tell us about the Broadacre Project. I found this fascinating part of your book.
That was the hardest chapter to write.
Was it?
He conceived of the idea of building communities on a different scale than they were in cities. He saw a variety of communities scattered around, and they would all have services, grocery stores within walking distance, the people who lived there, and there would be a lot of automobile traffic. He was a great admirer of the automobile, and that's why Paolo Soleri, who was a short-time apprentice with him, and then founded his own communities out in Scottsdale, said that's the big mistake of Frank Lloyd Wright. The mess we have today with cities is because Frank Lloyd Wright put so much stress on the automobile. But Broadacre City was never built. It was never intended to be built. In the book, I have some of the most severe criticisms of it. But if you look at Wright's architecture, you can see that even before he conceived Broadacre City, he was building according to some of the principles that he outlined in there. And then long after that, his Usonian homes, which he began building in around 1932, 33, 34, and thereafter, all reflected the kind of architecture he wanted in Broadacre City.
Hmm. Now, is there an example of a Usonian home that listeners might be familiar with? Are there any standing?
Yes, there's a very nice one, the Christian House at Purdue University, near right across the street from the Purdue Stadium. And it's owned by John Christian, and he has opened it up to the public by appointment, and he wants you to bring tour groups over there. It's a wonderful place to tour. That's probably the best close by example. But there are, you know, there's a Haynes House in Fort Wayne, Indiana, which I think you can tour. I didn't bring along the Frank Lloyd Wright Quarterly, which has a list of the places that are open. But the Christian House in Lafayette, Indiana, isn't that far from here.
Right.
And it's easy to track down and a very worthwhile place to visit.
Yeah. This book is about Frank Lloyd Wright is about the communities with which he worked. What led you to that approach?
Serendipity. I chaired an accreditation team to the Frank Lloyd Wright School of Architecture in 1992, and I didn't know anything about it. We went to a college just a mile or so from his home and studio in Oak Park, but he was long gone by then. You know, we knew about Wright, but we didn't know that much. And so I went out there to chair that committee, and my wife went with me, and we hit it off with the dean and his wife. And then they, we said to them, when you go, see, they go to Wisconsin every May, and they come back to Arizona in October. And we said, when you go to Wisconsin, why don't you stop in, and we'll host you overnight? And they did. And then they said, why don't you come up to Wisconsin this summer? And we did. And we invited them to stop again, and they probably stayed at our house 12 to 15 times. One of the early visits, they invited us to spend a month out there with them. And so in the summer of November of 1994, we really became residents in the Taliesin community. We had an apartment that we lived in there, and we ate all our meals with them, and we washed dishes, and we raked the gravel to even it out after the tourists had all gone through. And we became close to the dean and his wife particularly. He's now deceased, but she still is a dear friend. We became intrigued with the idea of how they could live together. If you noticed in the book, there are about 8 or 10 members of the Taliesin Fellowship today that have been with it more than 50 years. There's some that have been more than 60 years. Our close friend Cornelia Brierley, who gets fairly prominent play in the book, joined in 1934. She left in 1946 when she got married, but she came back 12 years later because she couldn't bear to be away. Mm. And she just had her 96th birthday. When you see how they live together and how they work together and everything is done together, and you don't lose their individuality in so doing. Then my wife and I published the book about the fellowship, excuse me, and that's based on interviews with the people who came and stayed. And when it came out, the former apprentices said, "That's okay, Marty's, but we deserve to be heard too." And so I thought, well, I don't want to just do a rerun of an oral history. And I began to do research. And I went to a Frank Lloyd Wright Building Conservancy meeting in 1999. When I came back, my wife said, "They didn't talk you into doing another book, did they?" And I said, "No, they didn't talk me into it. They just insisted on it." And so then we took the different approach. And once we began to understand the fellowship and the origins to it and Wright's previous connections with communities, like his Oak Park studio, which was very different. Paul Crudy at the University of Illinois is a real Wright expert, and he points out, and I do this in the book too. I probably would have done it if I hadn't read Paul, but he convinced me more that that's the case. In his Oak Park studio, the ones he really liked were the young employees that he had. When he had Marion Mahoney Griffin had an architecture degree from, she was Marion Mahoney then, and Walter Burley Griffin, she was MIT and he was University of Illinois, and William Drummond had a degree from the University of Illinois. He played them down. He called them boys, even though they were 4 years and 8 years younger than he. He had in mind one who came to him unformed. That's the way he liked to get them. That was Barry Byrne.
Yeah, you quote Mr. Wright in the book as saying, give me unformed architects or draftsmen. Give me unformed men and women, not people who have been to college.
That's right. Yeah. And he always disparaged colleges.
Interesting. This is the Afternoon Magazine. We're talking this afternoon about Frank Lloyd Wright. Our guest is Myron Marty. He's the author of Communities of Frank Lloyd Wright, Taliesin and Beyond. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with a phone call or by email, 333-9455, 800-222-9455, by email, will-talk@illinois.edu. We have some listeners who would like to talk with you this afternoon, so let's take a call. Our first caller this afternoon in Belgium on line 4. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you all. I have a couple, 3 points I'd like to make with your guest, and maybe they're not quite all on point with you. Number one, you talked about Sullivan and Wright, and really the person that doesn't get very much real play in that situation is Sullivan's wife, who really was very influential on both of them, if I remember right. The next point I'd like to bring up with you is the fact that he may very well have been a very good architect when it came to design, but so many of his buildings have pushed the limit of the building materials they put into it that now they have to be repaired so bad. And one coming to mind is Falling Water. It's particularly troublesome the way he pushed concrete way past where it should have been, and they had to do some serious repair on that because of that. And unfortunately, I lost my third one.
Oh, okay. Well, maybe stay on the line and maybe it'll come to you.
Sure.
Okay, so let's go for the first 2 points that the listener makes. Louis Sullivan's wife and then Falling Water and pushing building materials beyond where they were meant to go.
I don't know anything about Sullivan's wife, and I don't think she lived with him in Chicago, and she didn't play any part in his practice at all. To my knowledge, I can look that up, but I never ran across any reference to her at all.
Well, I thought she was, maybe I had the character wrong. I thought Sullivan's wife helped him draw and design and do a lot of the work that he did, and then Wright took a lot of Sullivan's ideas. Am I mistaken?
I think you're mistaken. I can look that up, but I've never run across that before in biographies of Sullivan or in any references to Wright.
Well, the second point, then.
As far as the building materials are concerned, that was a maddening thing for the apprentices, too. He designed all the buildings that at Taliesin West and most of them in Wisconsin, all of them in Wisconsin, too. And there's a story in the book about how when they were building the studio, they had to put up the big trusses 3 times because he put it up with green wood. And one of the reasons for that is that he didn't ever have any money. Cornelia Brierley, whom I referred to not long ago here, was often sent to town to buy lumber for the construction projects, and he always told her to get the cheapest that she could get. And so a lot of times she brought green, uncured lumber, and naturally that would warp when it got in place. They also, one time when we lived there for a week or so, I went to a closet that was down on the level where we were living, and I caught the look at the inside of the door, and I discovered that it was made out of a shipping crate from a railroad. So he was just patching things together. But you're right, he does not get credit for being a good builder. Design was his strength.
Thank you very much, sir.
You're very welcome. Next, we take a call from a listener in Urbana on line 1. Good afternoon.
Hi. One example of his design being ahead of materials is the Johnson Wax building, which leaked like a sieve, and they still loved him. I was going to ask you about his personality. I mean, he's always one step ahead of bankruptcy, and he was having students there at Taliesin. Was it his genius of design or force of personality or a combination of both that kept those kids coming to that Taliesin's? And the other question I had was, I one time saw a book that was pretty complete of all of his works in the United States, and some would say you could go in and some you just could drive by. But I have no idea. I've looked for that book again, and I don't know what it is.
You're looking for a book by William Allen Storer.
Okay, spell the last name, please.
S-T-O-R-E-R, might be two R's.
Okay.
He has pictures in there of all of Wright's built designs that he could get pictures of before they were torn down.
Yeah.
And then he also did a bigger book in which he has his drawings of floor plans. A lot of people are critical of those floor plans, but he tried to simplify them as much as he could. But that's, I wrote a review of a number of books and on Wright for, I was a regular reviewer for Taliesin Journal, and I said, of all the books that you, if you're going to get a book about Wright and you want to study his architecture, start with William Allen Storer.
Okay, that's great. And about how he kept Taliesin going on practically no money and keep having students come, how did he do that?
Well, he called them volunteers and he charged them $1,100 a year. there's a section in the book of where his cousin was studying at the University of Wisconsin and would come out and eat, and he said, you know, I don't know how these people could do it. They sat around and they worshipped Mr. and Mrs. Wright and they ate this gruel that they put out for them. He didn't know how he could do it, but he had that ability. And the division among the former apprentices is very clear. Those who really loved him and Mrs. Wright stayed after their apprenticeships were really over. I asked them how they knew when their apprenticeship was over, and that was when they started getting a paycheck instead of having to pay for their being there. They are the ones that love him. Those some who left because they were kicked out or asked to leave. He could be very cruel to them, particularly Mrs. Wright. She was the real, I think it's out of respect for my friends in the fellowship, I won't call her a tyrant, but she acted in tyrannical ways.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she meddled in their lives all the time. She set up relationships. There are probably four or five or six instances of where she arranged a marriage of a homosexual man with a woman, and they all failed, but she kept doing that. That was just her nature. But you go into any of their apartments or their rooms at Taliesin or Taliesin West, there will always be a picture of Mrs. Wright there. Not always of Frank Lloyd Wright, but of Mrs. Wright. She was the glue that held it together.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Let's take another call. A listener in Champaign on line two. Hello? Line two?
Yes.
Go ahead.
I hope you can hear me because I can barely hear you.
We can hear you.
I wonder if Sullivan's wife is really Walter Burley Griffin's wife.
That's who you're thinking of. That was Marion Mahoney Griffin.
Yes.
And she did a lot of his drawings. She was a superb artist. And she started drawing for him and then was drawn to him. And they married, and she did all the drawings for his big Canberra project in Australia.
Didn't she kind of give up her own?
She did.
Her own career as an architect to support him.
Well, not to support him, but to work with him.
Yes.
And that was support for him. But they were a real team, and that's who the earlier caller must have been thinking of.
Right. I took a course once in Mason City, Iowa. Where there are several Griffin houses.
Yeah.
And that was just so intriguing for me. And then he went on to plan Canberra, Australia. I don't want to get you off of Wright, but I find Griffin quite fascinating, too. So thank you.
Well, thanks for the call.
Absolutely. And Paul Crudy at the University of Illinois is a real authority in Walter Burley Griffin. He's been working on a book on him, and I belong to the society that Paul is very active in, the Walter Burley Griffin Society. And they produced a book about three homes in Decatur that were designed by Marion Mahoney Griffin, and where Walter Burley Griffin, who called himself a landscape architect, did the landscaping. They're wonderful homes. They're on Milliken Place. You can drive past them. They knock on the door, maybe they'll show them to you.
Yeah. WILL Television a few years ago did a documentary.
Is that right?
On Walter Burley Griffin, and I'm sure that it would be available in area libraries.
I think, was it broadcast on NPR, on PBS then?
I believe so.
I think you can still look view it online.
Okay.
And I was able to get the whole script for it, even parts of it that were cut. So that was very valuable for me to learn about Griffin.
Because he's part of the Griffins are part of the story.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the, was it third and final Mrs. Wright, correct? Or was it?
Yes, that's
third. Okay. I find her an interesting part of the story as well, because you write that she was his intellectual equal, and that she brought him serenity and security. And after Wright's death, Mr. Wright's death in 1959, she held Taliesin together.
Right? Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
I mean, she, and some people think that that was really the end of Taliesin, because she didn't take any new apprentices in. And when in 19... what year? I'm not sure what it would have been. 1982, which would have been the 50th anniversary of the founding of the fellowship. They went to her and asked her if she would cooperate with them to have a reunion of the former apprentices, and she declined. And they said, she said, it'll cost too much. They said, well, we've already raised the money. You won't have to put out anything. Well, still wouldn't agree. And finally they asked her why, and she said, because there will be too many people there that I don't like.
Oh, my.
So it's kind of a sad aspect of it.
Our second caller this afternoon raised the issue of money, and this is something that's bubbled through our conversation here this afternoon, the two of us speaking. Also, it comes out over and over and over again in the book, constant anxiety over money. And I think at one point you said, you write in the book, that what they would do is they would reassess their situation and take control. Tell us about this constant anxiety over money and how they were able to, how Frank Lloyd Wright was able to persevere through all these trying times.
Well, his philosophy is one that I would have a hard time living by, but he managed. His bank account was in his pocket, and he got paid for a commission once, and he called his wife and said, "I got this much money now. What do we really need?" And she said, "We really need a carpet sweeper." And the man who told me this story said she really did need a carpet sweeper. He was an apprentice there at the time. And he said, well, for the same amount of money, I can get a used harpsichord. And she said, bring the harpsichord. Mm. And his philosophy was, take care of the luxuries and the necessities will take care of themselves. And that's the way they lived. But there were a lot of conflicts over money. I mean, he lost some good apprentices. He had a broken relationship with his son, John Lloyd Wright, in Japan, because he was way, way behind in paying him. And when John Lloyd Wright picked up the money for a commission, a building on the Japanese, the Imperial Hotel in Japan, Wright owed him $1,000, and he kept that out of it and put the rest in the bank. And Wright sent a wire back and said, you're fired, take the next boat home. So he never worked with him again. But he did, he had had a close relationship with him previously. He's the one that went with Mr. Wright to Wisconsin when Mamie Borthwick Cheney was murdered. And he was really the sort of the clerk of the works in the building of the Midway Gardens in Chicago.
We can revisit that horrible disaster at Taliesin in 1914, was
14,
it?
Yeah.
But let's take a call first. A listener in Danville is waiting for us on line 4. Hello.
Hi. Do you think that the high cost of energy, heating, and so forth now would make some of the larger open space structures more obsolete in design?
I don't really feel competent to qualify to comment on that, but I know that Wright was aware of that, and that he would have designed buildings that that took that into account.
I just thought I didn't know for sure whether that was an important matter. For years, energy, the cost of gas, and all forms of heating was taken for granted. And then we found out in Illinois not long ago what had to happen to the cost of energy.
Most of his, they lived up in Wisconsin without any central heating system. All they had was fireplaces. That's one reason he took them to Arizona in 1937.
There you go.
And some of the apprentices, when they came in, their job was cutting the trees and splitting the logs and making the firewood for the fireplaces. But his heating style in Usonian houses was radiant heat with pipes in the floor. And we've been to several of those where they had their share of troubles with them. But people who own Wright houses today tend to have the wherewithal to make the changes in them.
Sure. Retrofit at all.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thanks for the
You're
call
welcome.
This afternoon. Our guest today is Myron Marty, author of Communities of Frank Lloyd Wright, Taliesin, and Beyond. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. You can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, toll-free 800-222-9455, by email will-talk@illinois.com. Well, 1914, this terrible disaster at Taliesin in Spring Green, Wisconsin. Tell us briefly what happened.
Well, what happened is that he left his wife and six children. And you could say of him what I said to a friend of mine who left his wife after having six children. He said he concluded he never loved her, and I said, well, you sure gave it a good try.
Wow.
Then they went to Europe, and they spent a couple of years there, and he really missed his family, but not his wife. He tried for years to get a divorce from her. Not till the 1920s did he get his divorce. But then he built Taliesin at Spring Green, Wisconsin, which became the headquarters for the Taliesin Fellowship. And he said he was building it as a home for his mother, but that was just one of his ruses. A lot of things that Frank Lloyd Wright said and wrote weren't true. His age, for example, he said that he was born in 1869. He was really born in 1867. In the first draft of this book, I accused him of being guilty of chronological inexactitudes. But I changed that because some people didn't think the term was right. When he was building that for her, and he was building Midway Gardens in Chicago, and the phone call came to Chicago that there'd been a tragedy. And so he and Mr. Cheney is how they pronounced it, I think, boarded the train, and they went up to Wisconsin together. And when they got there, they found that Mrs. Cheney, who by then was, I think, Mama Borthwick, and her two children and, I believe, five other people were murdered. Julian Carlton apparently had some sort of a grievance. They didn't know just what the grievance was. Locked all the doors to the dining room except one. He poured kerosene or some other inflammatory liquid under the doorway. He set fire to that, and as they rushed out the door, he killed them with an axe. Brutal. I mean, it was a terrible scene. There were some who survived who were able to describe it, and they became loyal followers of Wright. But he lost some really good friends and helpers. Emil Brogeur would have been a top-notch draftsman for him, and he was murdered there. And a touching story about his going to the burial place. I think that one of the reasons that the third Mrs. Wright always was rankled by the fact that he was buried in Wisconsin, and so was Mama. And when she died, she left it as her wish that his body be exhumed, cremated, and be buried next to her remains, which infuriated the people in Wisconsin. There was one former apprentice, a very good one, who will not set foot. He came one time to Taliesin. Because of that, he wouldn't set foot there. The first time he came back was 3 years ago for a funeral of Tom Casey. A woman named Miriam Noel sent Wright a sympathetic letter and soon began to move in with him, and they had a love-hate relationship. She must have satisfied some of his needs, but mostly they fought. Eventually, when he got a divorce from Catherine Wright, they were free to marry, and they married, and 6 months later, she moved out, and he tried to divorce her. And that was a long, painful struggle, too. She had him arrested for violating the Mann Act when he went to Wisconsin, and he spent time in jail up there. So did Mrs. Wright. They had a little girl by then. And so interesting stories.
Yeah. Well, let's go back to the idea of community and intentional community. Can you share with us your thoughts about the evolution of Wright's vision of intentional community? And also, he thought, apparently, of intentional community, it also should be organic.
Appropriate to the time and appropriate to the place and appropriate to the people.
Exactly.
You asked before what got me interested in this. At Drake University, I taught an honors course called America's Communal Utopias. I did Brook Farm and the Shakers and Amana and Oneida and New Harmony. And so I was intrigued with the idea of communities. And when I went out to Taliesin, and I taught there during that month, I taught a seminar on these other communities. And my wife worked in the archives and did transcribing of tapes. Then I began to interview some of the apprentices, senior fellows by then, and she transcribed them, and she did a 3 or 4 of them, and she said, "This is too good to just let on the shelf. We got to do a book." So that's where how that book evolved. But I don't think that he had a real concept of developing a utopian community. He was interested in a working community. And if I could have titled it differently, I would have called it The Working Communities of Frank Lloyd Wright. Mm. Publishers didn't like that title. I also thought about calling it Frank Lloyd Wright and Associates, like some architectural firms are named today. He only one time had a partner in his architectural office, and that was Aaron Green in San Francisco. But otherwise, he fired people if they claimed that they had run his business. He was so adamant that he says, "Where I am, that's where my practice is. That's where my business is. Wherever I am, that's it." And so his checking account
was
in his
pocket.
Yeah,
exactly.
Now, I'm sure I lost track of your question.
His vision of the intentional community, how did it evolve over time? Its roots go back to the days in Chicago with Sullivan, but it changed over time. And in 1931, he and the third Mrs. Wright, Olegovana, they had an idea for a school.
Yeah.
And they drew up a brochure, and it turned out to be too...
Very complicated.
Too complicated. So at the time Taliesin Fellowship began in 1932, what was his vision for intentional community and fellowship?
A key paragraph in every brochure that he published was, Taliesin would be a station for the flight of the soul. And he was going to run it on his terms. There would be no degrees. There would be no courses. There would be no requirements. It would be all learning by doing. And the apprentices it would be a working community. They'd work in the garden. They would work in the kitchen. And sometimes this posed problems. Tom Casey, our good friend, tells a story about one time when he got in on an argument between them. Mrs. Wright wanting them to stay and work in the kitchen, and Wright wanting them to go out and do some building. And he said, well, by God, how am I ever going to get these things done? And the doors slammed. But Tom said they always made up again somehow. But his vision for it was to be a distinctive place, a place to get away from the world that he thought was contaminated, the world of architectural studies where he thought was really bad. And when people would come and say they hadn't studied architecture before, he'd put his arm around them and say, that's the kind of person we like to get here. And the amazing thing is that sometimes they'd be there 6 months to a year, and he would send them out to supervise the construction of a building that he had designed. They just, you know, there was something, some sort of immersion that went all the way through them.
We talked a little bit about it. You talked a little bit about the utopian societies, and they weren't really a model for Taliesin Fellowship.
Not at all.
But what about the Bauhaus School? Was there anything else on the horizon that Frank Lloyd Wright saw and thought, you know, that's interesting what they're doing?
Bauhaus, he was very much opposed to.
Exactly.
He was very intrigued with Saarinen's at Cranbrook. But the difference was that Cranbrook's got a lot of money from the newspaper family that that hired Eliel Saarinen and designed the whole Cranbrook. Have you been to Cranbrook?
No.
It's a spectacular place. And when Taliesin apprentices would go up there, they'd say, man, this is different. They got money. They can buy what they need. At Taliesin, when they built Taliesin West, they would build the forms for them, putting up what they call the desert rubble walls. Take the forms down, and they would drive the nails out of them because they would use them again. Save the nails. They didn't have money to buy nails. Cornelia told me that she read my chapter on the building of Taliesin West, and she said, there's one thing you should put in there, and I did. She said, this is probably the only public building, it's really not public, but it's open to the public, where the people who built it come back and rub the rocks or the stones that they put in and say, I helped build this. Mm-hmm. They all remember what they did when they were out there because it meant so much to them.
Let's take another call. This is a listener in Bourbonnais on line one. Hi.
Hi. Bourbonnais is just up the road from Kankakee, which you, of course, know is home to two 1900 Frank Lloyd Wright houses, mm-hmm. the Bradley and the Hickox. And I am a member of a committee. Both these houses are now in private ownership, and as a matter of fact, both are for sale. And so a group of people in town is trying to raise the money to buy these for the public and turn them into mm-hmm. something.
Mm-hmm.
I'm calling to ask what advice you can give us to succeed at this. And B, can you tell us anything, any really fascinating lesser-known facts about these houses?
Well, we were allowed to step into the entry to the Bradley House when it was the home for a law office. We didn't try the Hickok House. Both of them are spectacular places. The stable at the Bradley is falling down, or was falling down.
No, it's been resurrected.
It has. Okay.
The owner has resurrected it.
Well, the first thing is find some rich people that are interested in investing in it. Second is build a lot of community support for it.
Okay.
And you know, if you have some sort of an event where you'd like to have me come up and talk to them about Wright and his buildings and his organization, and I'll be glad to do that.
That would be wonderful.
It takes a community spirit. The other thing you might do is to get in touch with Bob McCoy, Dr. Robert McCoy,
uh-huh.
Who's a a surgeon, orthopedic surgeon, that's the word I was looking for, in Mason City.
Okay.
And he is the one that spearheaded the restoration of the Stockman House there and of the hotel that Wright built, and he's working on what became the bank. And he lives in a Griffin house, and he was the one that spearheaded all the efforts up there. And if you could get him to come over as a consultant, he would wow them. He's a wonderful person.
Okay.
I'd be happy to come up at the same time that he's there.
That would be wonderful.
We're friends, but I don't claim to be intimate with him. When we're at meetings, we always visit with each other, and I like him, and I send him things, and he comes to conferences. He's a wonderful man. His wife is also. I think her name is Bonnie.
Okay.
He'd be a terrific resource for you.
All right. Well, thank you. That's great.
You're welcome.
Would you fall into the camp that would say that the Bradley is the first pure prairie house?
I don't think so. What's the date on it? I didn't bring my story book in with me.
1901, I'm pretty sure.
Okay, then, because the Dana House would be about 1906 or 1908 in Springfield.
Okay.
Yeah, that could be one of the first. You know, you always have to be careful with calling anything of rights the first.
Yes, okay.
But good luck with that. I'd really love to see you do that. We have friends who stayed there when it was a bed and breakfast. They stayed there on their honeymoon.
Wow.
And so it's been through a number of iterations, and I hope you can get it. Another thing you should do is talk to the people at the Dana Thomas House in Springfield.
Okay.
Regina Albanese is the executive director there, and our good friends Carl and Roberta Volkman were very instrumental in saving that house.
Okay.
And getting the state to do what they did with it.
I believe that's closed, isn't it?
No, that's been reopened. It's open now Wednesday through Sunday.
Okay.
And it's operating very well. In fact, I'm going to go with a group of Monticello school children, high school students, on the 10th of March to take them through it.
It's just a week.
Yeah, an interesting question from the geometry teacher. I've never been a guest instructor in a geometry class before, but she wants me to talk to them about how Wright used geometry in his designing of his buildings.
Interesting.
Well, you'll have plenty to say.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for the call this afternoon. Yes, go ahead.
Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Here to wrap up, we're right out of time. Is there a biography or two you recommend for listeners interested in Frank Lloyd Wright?
There really is not a good biography.
Really?
This comes as close to, my book comes as close to being a biography, but it lets out a lot of the stuff that sells books today. You know, I didn't.
Have you read T.C. Boyle's novel, The Women?
I haven't.
Yeah,
I'm
looking forward to reading it. It's now out in paperback, and it's a novel about Wright's life as told through the experiences of the women who were near and not so dear to him.
There was a man named Bill Marlin that was sort of commissioned to write a biography, and he did a lot of research, gathered all kinds of materials, and died of a heart attack. And so the Frank Lloyd Wright archives have all of his materials there, but they haven't found anybody to do it. You can piece together, though, books on aspects of Wright's life. And I'm not embarrassed to say that I think this is as good a chronology of Wright's life as you'll find. But there's a whole lot more than this. The books about, like, Donald Huffman has written remarkably good books, one on the Dana Thomas House, one on Falling Water, one on the Robie House in Chicago. A couple more. They're slender volumes, 8.5 by 11 format, beautifully illustrated. I would recommend them as a good way to get things. But if you want to get into the seamy sides of Wright's life, there's one by Brendan Gill that I wouldn't recommend. But it's an interesting
New Yorker
book. Yeah, it's an interesting book, but he's way off base on a bunch of things.
And there we've got to leave it. We're out of time. Myron Marty, thank you so much for talking with me this afternoon. He is the author of Communities of Frank Lloyd Wright, Taliesin and Beyond. It's a fascinating book. It is published by the Northern Illinois University Press.
And that interview is from the Focus 580 archives from about 3 weeks ago. It's 5 minutes before 2 o'clock. Settlement prices now from the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. And with the grain numbers, here's AM 580 Agriculture Director Dave Dickey.
Thank you very much, Tom. And good afternoon, everyone. It was a difficult day in Kansas City and Chicago. and even the soybeans, which started out promising to the plus side with bull spreading a feature, ended up giving up all of its gains on the day, although bull spreading remained a feature just to the downside. Let's look at the particulars in Kansas City. May wheat, a high price on the day of 494, a low of 485, settlement at 485 down 9. July, a high of 504.5, a low of 495.5, settlement 495.75 down 9.25 on the day. May wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade at 489, the high, the low 475.5, the settlement 476.75 down 9.75. July, a high of 501.25, a low of 488, settlement 489.25 down 9.75. December wheat, a high of 542.5, a low of 533.5, settlement at 534.25 down 6.5. Let's go out to July of 2011, a high of 592.5, a low of 586, settlement 585.5 down 6 on the day. May corn, a high of 372.25, a low of 362.5, settlement at 362.75 down 8. July, a high of 383.25, a low of 373.5, settlement at 373.75 down 8. December corn, a high of $4.25, a low of 392, settlement 392.25 down 7. March of 2011, a high of 410.75, a low of 403, settlement of 403.25 down 6.75. July of 2011, a high of 423.25, a low of 415.75, settlement 415.75 down 6.75 on the day. Your harvest month a year out, December of 2011, a high of 418.25, a low of 410.75, settlement 410.75 down 7. May oats, a high of 221, a low of 215.5, settlement 216.5 down 2. The July contract also off 2 on the day, the high 229.75, the low 224.75, the settlement 225. May soybeans, a high of 976.5, a low of 964.75, settlement 968 down a half. July, a high of 984, a low of 972, settlement 975.5 down 1.25. September beans, a high of 960.5, a low of 949.25, settlement 951.25 down 6.25. Your harvest month, a high of 946.75, a low of 933.75, settlement at 936 down 9.75. January of 2011, a high of 954.5, a low of 941.75, settlement 944 down 9.75. July of 2011, a high of 970.25, a low of 967.25, settlement 964.25 down 6.75. May soybean meal, a high of 274.40, a low of 269.90, settlement 271.90 up 50. July ended flat on the day, the high 273, the low 268.5, settlement 270.40. May beans, on the soybean oil side, a high of 39.90, a low of 39.48, settlement at 39.54 down 18, and the July at 40.31, the low 39.92, the settlement 39.95 down 20 on the day. Settlement prices also in from the Merck. We'll have those in just a second. This is Dave Dickey.
Support for WILL comes from Stuart Peterson, since 1985 offering strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks by developing dynamic strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information is at stuart-peterson.com.
Now, a quick look at the Merck livestock side in Chicago. April live cattle had a high of 96.95, the low 95.25. Settlement price today, 95.70. It was down 140 on the day. The June contract, the high 94.30, the low 92.35. Settlement 92.37.5, 170. The rest of the table is also down. The March feeder cattle contract, the high today, 105.40, the low 104.70. And the settlement price just under the high at 105.37.5. That was up 67.5.